And tonight we look at contributions to unity, whereas last week it was about the structure of unity. And so what we see here is Paul is detailing a contrast of attitudes, actually, in verses 3 and 4. And he freely and plainly discusses what will not contribute to unity as well as what will contribute to unity. And what he teaches on this matter is valuable for us and the unity of believers in a local church. So it's good to look at, really all four verses, but for the sake of time, we've kind of split them up here a little bit. And tonight we look at the second part. Now, in verse 3, do nothing from selfish or empty conceit, but with humility of mind, let each one of you regard one another as more important than himself. Do not merely look out for your own personal interests, but also for the interests of others. And while this was written to a local congregation in the city of Philippi, when we would read this, we would find out, yes, it's good instructions, it's going to contribute to the unity of the whole group. But it's an effort that's made by each one individually to accomplish this. And so what he's doing here is that he discusses a few things, and the first thing that we want to consider is a personal frame of mind. And he says here, and these words differ from translation to translation. I've got the New American Standard Bible tonight that says that the personal frame of mind and accomplishing unity is not going to come through selfishness and empty conceit. Now, some translations will have selfish ambition. And the idea there is of the selfishness or the selfish ambition or strife. It's just strife, striving about something that something's going on. And, you know, if you study the subject of selfishness as it's described in the Bible and look at some examples and other things, and a lot of times what you've got to do, you've got to look at things that are the reverse of selfishness to really get a good picture of what selfishness is. And what you find is that, you know, there's selfishness behind a lot of things that happen. Personal relationships, problems in employment, problems at school. Just any number of things. You find selfishness behind this at the base of it. And as a matter of fact, when you think about in personal relationships and families and things like that, selfishness is a big problem. And selfishness, whether one cares to look at this or not, whenever you get past everything else and all the other things that happen when a marriage breaks up, when you begin to dig in and get down to where the root problem is, you're going to find that one or the other, or both, are afflicted with selfishness. This is what it's, you know, it's what it's about. Have a young person come to you and say, I just don't love him anymore, or I'm just not happy, and a number of other things along that line. And it's just, it is really, a lot of times, it's just selfishness. Things haven't turned out like I thought they'd turn out. I'm sure that, I remember seeing this one time on a show I liked. It was kind of an interview being done, not in the best of ways. But there was a lady of the house, she wife, and she was in the kitchen. And the person doing the interview said, is your husband what you thought he would be? And you could see how the question really just grabbed a hold of her. She just stopped what she was doing. I don't remember what she was doing, but she just stopped and looked at the wall that was about 2 or 3 feet away from her. And there's this long pause, and then she looked over toward the interviewer very slowly. No, he's not. He's yours. Good follow-up. I thought to myself many times since seeing that particular scene, and thinking to myself, there's no doubt that she may have thought that her husband was a knight in shining armor, that he would provide everything, never be a problem, and it would all be filled with tenderness and all those other things, like a Hallmark movie, you know. And he wasn't. But I think to myself, how many are? No, we're all flawed individuals, aren't we? And we're probably not what we would think that we would hope to be. One of my favorite songs got the line in it, I wish I was everything that you had thought that I would be. Now, I think also, though, there are those marriages that are successful and two people start out. And after a while, maybe 10 years, 20 years, 40 years, you find out, no, that person's not like the one that I married. They've gotten better. And that's always a good thing, too. So there's always room for improvement. But selfishness, when it enters into the picture, it just flat out jerks the rug out from under any kind of improvement or advancement and can only contribute to so many problems. When you think about it in a relationship here that he's talking about with unity in the church, selfishness is going to create this craving honor and prestige for self. And we've probably seen this. And you know, you see this from people who deny it. With their last breath, they deny this. And yet it's what they've done. And the only really, you know, prestige and honor that anyone would deserve would be Jesus. That's it. But sometimes that gets lost as things go along. Look at Philippians chapter 1 here. And we'll see where there's some rivalry and jealousy. It says, some, to be sure, are preaching Christ even from envy and strife, but some also from goodwill. The latter do it out of love, knowing that I am appointed for the defense of the gospel. But the former, he says, proclaim Christ out of selfish ambition rather than from pure motives, thinking to cause me distress in my imprisonment. Well, the rivalry you see here, jealousy, and somehow or another thinking that you can do a better job than Paul, and with the idea of kind of showing him up. You really think Paul would care if someone could accomplish more or anything like that, if it was all, and no, he wasn't. He thinks they're really doing me harm, but really they're not. But sometimes that's what's done. And when you consider if selfishness is involved, there's also this as a personal agenda is always present. It's always something. And it could be something that's, you know, decades old. And it's just transferred over as time goes on. Churches sometimes change in their whole complexion of the members and things like that. And so people change, but you know, personal agendas generally don't. They're just passed on and they're carried on, and all this, all for just a no good end. Empty conceit, or some translations have vain glory, is mentioned there. Romans chapter 12, in dealing with a whole list of just real good advice on a personal level, says in Romans 12, verse 16, be of the same mind toward another, one another. Do not be haughty in mind, but associate with the lowly. Do not be wise in your own estimation. And then another thing that we have, and it crops up a lot of times, and it's the word arrogant is what it is in the New American Standard Bible. In the older translations, in the King James and in the New King James, I believe it's also in the American Standard Version, there's a different word that's used, and it's the word puffed up. An interesting word, and a most accurate word. When you think that it's really talking about arrogance, that's what it's really talking about. And if you do some investigation of the Greek word that's used here as puffed up, Well, it takes this word from smithing, where you got the big fire in there and you heat things up, heat metal up, and then you forge the metal as a result of that. Well, there's a device that's used to fire up the fire to get it, a little more intense and things. And it could be a number of things. It could be a hand thing, where you do this, blows air in there. And it could be that. Or it could be, I've seen the big ones that went on a big furnace. And you had a handle up here, and you grabbed that, and you pulled down on that, and the bellows over here was a big deal. And boy, it could puff that thing up and get the fire going. And so that's where the word comes from. It comes from the word that actually describes one of these things, the bellows. Now, in common terms, what's a bellows? It's a windbag. And we're talking about what here? Arrogance. So arrogance is what? Somebody who's a windbag. It's kind of a play on words, but a real good one. And when you think about that and think about how the one who's arrogant is puffed up. What's he puffed up? Well, puffed up kind of with himself a little bit. That's right. One place where this is used, and there's a number of them, a lot of them in the Corinthian letters, but in 1 Corinthians chapter 4 and verse 6 is a real good one, where it says, "These things, brethren, I have figuratively applied to myself and Apollos for your sake, that in us you might learn not to exceed what is written, in order that no one of you might become arrogant or puffed up in behalf of one against the other." And that's what being arrogant, being puffed up, they all contribute to this. All these things, you're not going to see unity because everybody's lining up against somebody else, or somebody is, and they just keep it going all the time. Unity will not exist, will not and cannot exist in a climate where ambitious men wish to elevate themselves. Back to Romans 12 again. And I have always liked verse 3. I like verse 3 because it's something that serves as a reminder to me. But it speaks so much about what's common with problems in churches where there's a lack of unity. Through the grace given to me, I say to every man among you, not to think more highly of himself than he ought to think. Not to be arrogant. Not to be filled with selfishness and empty conceit. But to think as to have sound judgment, or to think soberly, sober-minded, as God has allotted to each a measure of faith. So we can see what he's talking about there, and those things, if we could get the absence of those things, that it would be good, and unity would have an opportunity to flourish. But then he also says that we should have lowliness of mind. That doesn't mean to think about low things or something like that, or not to have any expectations, or not to have goals and so on. It doesn't mean that. That's not what the lowliness of mind would mean. Sometimes it's referred to as humility or humbleness of mind. It's used that way in different translations. Colossians chapter 3, verse 12 has, "And so, as those who have been chosen of God, holy and beloved, put on a heart of compassion, kindness, humility, gentleness, and patience." So it's mentioned over there as well. But now here's the thing. While we might recognize the importance of humility and how that'll work, and the humility and the humbleness, and wouldn't that go a lot to dispel the other things we've looked at already? Well, they would. No question about it. But now here's something that we learn, and this is sad to consider, that this is what happens. The world does not recognize lowliness and humility as a virtue. No, they don't. The world recognizes lowliness and humility as a fault. Quite a difference, isn't it? And so we can see how, with this kind of a difference, how there seems to be so much confusion and so many different things and a lack of unity and harmony in the world. But in the Lord's church, there should be when these things are absent and when there is lowliness of mind that's practiced. And in the Lord's church and by God, lowliness and of mind, humility, humbleness, is actually a virtue. Jesus, we are told, in Matthew chapter 11, verse 29, was gentle and humble in heart. He says he was meek and lowly. But we can understand exactly what that means. And here's another thing. This lowliness of mind is proven, as it says here, when we regard another as more important than yourselves. That's how it's proven. And that's what it says there in our text. Now, point number two, there's our relationship with others. I'll just go back on this where it says, do not merely look out for your own personal interests, but also for the interests of others. So our relationship with others is not according to my own interests. Now, this does not mean that we just ignore our own needs. That's not what it's saying at all. I'm afraid over the years that it has to a lot of religious people, and you know, and they've just decided that if they had anything, that somehow or another this was wrong. I've met members of the church where the thing that seemed to bother them more than anything else, and the thing that they would do their best to avoid, was success. You know, just being successful at something. There's nothing wrong with being successful at something. You know, when we look at that case where Jesus taught about the parable of we always call it the parable of the rich fool, the man who had plenty, and he was a very successful farmer, and he said, I'm going to tear down my barns and build bigger barns. Now, people will think, unfortunately, that the problem was with him that he was rich, that he was successful. He set out to do something, be a farmer, be good at it, and he was, and there you go, and that's what was wrong. And what do they suggest as the answer? Well, they suggest as the answer, I guess, failure. You know, you just ought to get in business and then just, you know, go belly up. Of course, that would be ridiculous. Well, they're missing the whole point. The problem wasn't that the man was rich. The problem was what the man did about being rich. And he left no room in his busy life for God. He thought that this was all I need, and this will provide everything for me. And he's just going to sit back finally and kick his feet up in the air and say, I've really got it made. And look at it. And it's all because of myself. He didn't leave any room for God at all. And that's what the problem was with that individual. So, it's not saying here, like some think, and that parable's not teaching that we just ignore our own needs or anything along that line. That's still something that's important. But it's a warning, rather, not to get caught up in ourselves. We get caught up in ourselves. It seems as though whenever someone gets caught up in themselves, that what gets shoved out as more things enter into the picture, more involvement, more things to do, more hobbies, more whatever it is, as these things start to enter in as they're being taken in, something's being shoved out of the way to make room for these. And what's generally shoved out of the way is God and interest in Him, attending services. I don't have time to read the Bible anymore. I'm too interested in whatever is going on and things like that. But then you compare this to the points that came along before this. Well, what were those points? Well, once again, they were selfishness and empty conceit. And so you don't get caught up in yourselves, because that's what that is right there. So you don't think about yourself so much. And one way of not thinking about yourself, one way to temper that, is to be concerned about others, in helping others and doing things for others and things along that line. So that's the second part of it, according to the interest of others. Now, there's a command about our duties to others. Look at, it's several places. I've got a couple of them up here from Matthew, but Matthew 19 is one. when Jesus had his conversation with the one that we call the rich young ruler. And he told him a number of things that he ought to be busy doing. In the latter, in Matthew 19, verse 19, honor your father and mother. Now here's the second part, it's what we're interested in. You shall love your neighbor as yourself. Now later on, when Jesus was asked about the greatest commandment, in his answer he said, well, you'll love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, and mind. And then he says, and the second is like unto it, you'll love your neighbor as yourself. Matthew chapter 22 and verse 39. So there are commandments that are given in the Old Testament. But now the Lord uses them again because this is still something that's necessary. Now, it's not necessary because it's found in the Old Testament. It's not necessary because it's found in both. It's necessary because it's what's found in the New Testament. And it is the tenor of the New Testament is to be a servant. And a servant always serves someone else. Sometimes it might be that we're serving God. Sometimes we're serving Christ. And sometimes we're serving one another. And so there's the idea. So there's a commandment about this and being about the interests of others. Now, obviously, you can only stretch yourself so far. You can't help everybody. Nobody can do that. People think that there's those that can do that, but you just can't do that. But at the same time, there are some that you can help. And it would be a sad state of affairs if there were opportunities that came my way and I never did anything about it. But yes, we ought to be sensitive to the interests of others. And especially is that the case when it comes to brethren. Jesus said, a new commandment I give you, that you love one another. It's always seemed to me that loving one another meant that you were, well, you cared about one another. I was out in Arkansas for 8 years. And when I got there, there was a tendency on the part of the people who have been longtime members there to always live in the past. And I don't know. That's kind of a curiosity, you know. Nostalgia is a fine thing, but you can't live in the past. Talking about, people always say how they remember when you didn't have to lock your doors when you left to go somewhere. You know, you could go to town and didn't have to lock doors on your house and so on. I've always thought about that, and I guess when I was a little boy and we lived in the country over there at Shoals, when we went to town, we didn't lock our doors. Of course, we didn't have anything anybody could steal, but that's one of the reasons why we didn't lock our doors. But nostalgia, you know that. And they would just kind of get stuck in this. And there was a preacher that had been there, and he didn't like the noise of conversation before services. Now, from what I gather, he thought everybody ought to come in and sit down, you know, quietly, and no conversations going on or anything like that. And so they thought that that was unusual. Now, to be honest with you, I thought it was unusual too. I asked him, I said, has this fellow been preaching very long? And it turned out he had. But I've always thought to myself, that's not a bad thing. It doesn't show irreverence or anything like that. I've always thought the fact that there were people engaged in conversation before services tells me that it's people that are interested in others, having a conversation, listening to what your week's been like. You're listening to what my week's been like. Good, bad, all those things. All in there together. And that it wasn't something that was detrimental and ought to just be stopped and was something that was terrible, but actually it was a good thing. It shows life in a congregation. And I think that, you know, as brethren, we're supposed to be doing that. That's part of our loving one another. In Romans chapter 12 and verse 10, Romans 12 again, be devoted to one another in brotherly love, give preference to one another in honor. And Galatians chapter 6 and verse 10, be ready to do good unto all men, especially those of the household of faith. You know, give preference to them. So what we ought to be is we ought to be try to be sensitive to the interests of others and to their needs and things along that line. In 1 Thessalonians chapter 4 and verse 11, to make it your ambition to lead a quiet life and attend to your own business and work with your hands just as we commanded you. So you be sensitive to the interests of others, but now stop short in being what's described here and over there in Peter, more plain words, as being a busybody. And we work with our hands, and we try to lead a quiet life. And in doing all that, that doesn't mean we shut others out, doesn't mean we just focus on ourselves, but it means that we are trying to be sensitive to the interests of others and to be of assistance. Now, our third point and last point is that disciples are servants. It seems like that would be easy to point out, and it is. But at the same time, sometimes that's kind of difficult to be a servant. In Luke chapter 9 and verse 23, Jesus has this to say, "If anyone wishes to come after me, let him deny himself, take up his cross daily, and follow me." Now that's worded differently. Other places you're going to find "take up his cross," and the word "daily" won't be there, but Luke has the word "daily" in there. Now it doesn't say in here, "let him deny himself certain things." Now it doesn't say that. It says, "let him deny himself." So we want to rein in self and our selfish interests and those conceits and other things like that and be humble. You know, if we work with our hands, if we support ourselves, there's a good chance that, yeah, now we can help others. And so we're involved in denying ourselves and we take up his cross. He said, "Saint, you take up my cross. You take up your cross. You've got things that you need to do and you need to bear and do that." And what else does he say? He says, "and follow me." Follow Jesus. Follow him as our example. In Luke chapter 22, Jesus talks about service. He does it over in Matthew chapter 20. I know it's there. I believe it's in Mark as well. But Luke chapter 22 is where we want to look tonight, and starting with verse 24. "There arose a dispute among them as to which of them was regarded to be greatest." By the way, that wasn't the only time something like this had come up. It was a problem among those that became the apostles. They had this kind of problem. So Jesus comments on this by saying, "The kings of the Gentiles lord it over them, and those who have authority over them are called benefactors. But not so with you." In other words, he's saying, that's fine for them to do that. That's fine. But there's something better expected of you. Well, what is that? "Let him who is the greatest among you become the youngest, and the leader as the servant." So become as one who needs assistance as well, not just someone who's, you know, so full of themselves and arrogant and other things. And whoever's the leader, he really didn't have one. But the idea that the person who leads is the one who serves. That's the one who's important. Not what they were thinking. Who is greater? The one who reclines at table or the one who serves? Is it not the one who reclines at the table? But I am among you as the one who serves. In Matthew's account, it says that the Son of Man did not come to be served. He came to serve. And sometimes that's something that we forget about. But Jesus is our example of a servant as we ought to be. And if we are being a servant and are doing as we ought to be, and we're not creating problems, no, we're more of solving problems and helping out in ways and promoting unity. Paul, in 1 Corinthians 9, and we looked at this a little bit this morning, but 1 Corinthians 9, verses 19 through 23, where he says, "And though I am free from all men, I have made myself a slave to all," or a servant to all, "that I may win the more. And to the Jews I became as a Jew, that I might win the Jews. To those under the law, as under the law, though not being myself under the law, that I might win those who are under the law. To those who are without Christ, as without law, as without Christ, though not being without the law to God, but under the law of Christ, that I might win those who are without law. To the weak, I became weak, that I might win the weak. I have become all things to all men, that I may, by all means, save some. And I do all things for the sake of the gospel, that I may become a fellow partaker of it. Do you not know that those who run in a race all run, but only one receives the prize? Run in such a way that you may win. And everyone who competes in the games exercises self-control. They then do it to receive a perishable wreath, but we an imperishable. Therefore, I run in such a way as not without aim. I box in such a way as not beating the air. But I buffet my body and make it my slave, lest possibly, after I have preached to others, I myself should be disqualified." There's preparation for everyone who runs in a race, and everybody who runs in a race needs to be ready for it. And everybody who runs in a race, there's some that will, yes, they'll cross the finish line in first place. But I can look back at the times whenever I ran track, and everybody did run the race. Even the person who came in last still crossed that finish line. They ran the race. We're all running the race. And as a result of this, if we're all running the race, we do the best that we can. We try to run in such a way that you can win. He gives some advice here on how to be successful in this. But when he becomes all things to all people, he becomes a servant to all so that he might win some. And really, that ought to be what motivates us. Take your songbooks, turn to the songs been selected. Nothing poses more of a threat toward unity in a local church than internal strife and conflict. And really, these passages bear this out. And also, nothing promotes unity more than a practice where concern for one another is both spoken and is practiced. Actually, where concern for one another becomes paramount. And what a person can do to be a good servant of Jesus Christ is to first become a child of God by believing in the gospel and being obedient to it. And sometimes things do get in the way, and sometimes things have a tendency to enter into the picture, and God, Jesus, the church kind of get crowded out, but that can be corrected. And now's a good time, if correction needs to be made or there needs to be a rendering of obedience, for that to take place. If you're subject to the gospel invitation, why don't you come all together, we stand and sing.